Viola Williams, Reel 19. So after Somalia, we come to Ghana, I think, don't we?
Just about.
Yes.
But it was interesting that in the exodus from Somalia, I stayed on the way back to England. I stayed in Khartoum because there was a Ministry of Education inspector there running a school or a university or something who I knew very well. And I stayed there. And I would stay there for the best part of the week, I suppose, on my way back to England. And that came in extremely useful later. I read them when I let you much later on in my life. So it, nothing's ever completely wasted. I came back to England, and the Ministry of Overseas Development then said, would I like to go to Ghana? And they wanted to... Ghana had been independent then for... 6 years, just on 10 years, I suppose, with Kwame Nkrumah in charge. And they said, would I like to go to Ghana and set up a training school for hotel staff? And so I hastily did a short course at one of the YWCA's cafeterias in London, so at least I did know something about it, because up to then I knew nothing about that. Went out to Ghana to work with the Ghana government, because of course being overseas development it would be with the government, and discovered that A, there was only one hotel in, as far as I can make out, in Ghana, that already had its own little training school, and there would seem to be no possibility of further activity in that line. So if I'd been, I suppose if I'd been really honest, I'd have said to the overseas development people that this was a dead end. But I liked Ghana, and so I looked around to see what else there was available, and discovered that the YWCA in Ghana was going through an extremely difficult period. And so I asked the MIN if I could stay out there and still seconded to the government, but after a fashion, but work with the YWCA. So they let me stay there, and we had a really tough time, because Nkrumah was red, and he had the National Council of Women, which was his supporting body of women, who were redder of the red. And they were closing down all the non-governmental organisations, the Boy Scouts, the Girl Guides, the various church groups, and we were an absolutely prime target, of course. But luckily, our chairman, our president, was Annie Jaggi, who may have come into some of the records anyway, because she was the first black American, first black high court judge in the Commonwealth, and she was a power in the land, and even Kwame Nkrumah wasn't going to tangle with her. She was chairman of the UN Commission on Women. I mean, she was a really tough nut, and she was our chairman. So we did survive, but it was a very, very tricky period, and we had a good cafeteria going there, and every day at lunchtime there was an Nkrumah spy came in and sat in the corner and made notes about who was talking to who and what was there. If you wanted to say anything to anybody, the only really safe way to do it was to swim out to sea and lie on the waves and talk. And that was done quite considerably by a lot of people, I think. It was altogether a tricky period.
What was the regime like at that time? You say this is when he turned against the West. And although he was supposed to be non-aligned...
No, he'd got Russians there, and he'd got Chinese. It was interesting because we had very bad relations. I mean, there was no other word for it, with the National Council of Women. I mean, we were the only other organisation that was standing out there. And therefore, if they could irritate us in any way, they did. We were starting a group of women because the market women were the power in the land there. They were the ones who mostly got the money. And we were going to do a program with them on looking after their children, setting up a nursery group in the markets to look after the children who otherwise were sitting on their mother's backs in the sun in the markets. And we called a meeting in Accra of the market women, and they came, I won't say in their thousands, but they certainly came, there were several hundred there. And we were just about to start the meeting when Margaret Marte, who was chairman of the National Council of Women, the Nkrumah lot, swept in with her bodyguard, took over the platform, brought in the television people, brought in the radio people, brought in the newspaper people, and having said her piece, swept out again and left us to run the meeting and get it all going. But she got all the publicity in the media, all the publicity. It was Margaret Marte runs a most wonderful meeting of the market women. There was nothing whatever for bloody well to do with her. That was the kind of thing we were up against. But and then of course I was there for 3.5 years, and that. While I was there, I did something which I don't know if it's relevant for what you want, but it's something which I have found very relevant since, and that is, while I was there, the World Council of Churches asked me if I could possibly go over to Kenya for two months to do a job over there for them. That there was an emergency job that they wanted doing on something or other, and my ministry didn't seem to mind. So I went over there for 2 months in the middle, towards the end of my Ghana trip. And it was the best 2 months that I spent in Ghana. I was in Kenya, but it left my mob in Ghana to do their own thing with anything that they got from me in the previous 2 years. But it meant that they stood on their own feet. They discovered what they could do and what they still wanted help with. And I always maintain that of the 3.5 years I spent in Ghana, the best 2 months were the two I spent in Kenya. And I've tried to do that since when I've been working in other countries, to try and leave them to it for a period, and then go back and see where the help was still needed. There was trouble in Ghana the whole time we were there, because there was a strong opposition man who finally went to jail, and the jails were full of political prisoners. It was a mess. And then Kwame had a meeting in China, and he went over to China, and while he was there, the military had a coup. And it was this was something which I found absolutely fascinating. We had a dinner party up in Burma camp, as I got on, being an NGO, I mean, one could get in on with everybody, and I got on very well with the army while I was there. And I was at a dinner party in the army camp, up in Burma camp, and the coup happened at 4 o'clock the next morning. And it was so well kept. I mean, there we were, all enjoying ourselves, having a good meal and a dance and everything. And it talk about the Duchess of Richmond's ball at Waterloo. It was almost exactly the same, because I was woken up the next morning by the telephone. Now, this was the British High Commission to say that a coup had taken place. And would I please stay at home? Because it wasn't really safe to be out in the streets. And so I stayed in, and I listened to the radio, and there was music on the radio. There wasn't anything else on the radio except music. And then about 9 o'clock, my house girl arrived, and I said, because she came from the other side of a car, and I said, "Hello, Matilda. I wasn't expecting you today. How did you get here?" She said, "Well, it was very peculiar because the bus came a very funny way," and that was all she knew of the coup. And then on the radio, and this I think was this is one of the reasons why I love Ghana as a country. In the middle of the coup, on the radio, there was an announcement. The common entrance examinations will take place tomorrow as planned. In the middle of a coup. And a little time afterwards, the High Commission rang up and said that they thought it would probably be safe for me to go. They suggested I went the back way into the office, not the main way, because I was quite a long way out. And on the way in, I was stopped over and over again by armed Africans who poked their rifles in through the window. And they had one question, and one question only: "Are you a Russian?" And I said my very best and most polite English: "No, I am not a Russian, I am English, and I am working with the YWCA. "Oh," they said, "that's all right." Because the only damage that was done in Accra was to the Russian, I don't know whether it was the High Commission or anyway, but it was the Russian compound, and that was the only major shooting that took place. And so they didn't want me, if I was a Russian, to be charging that. And I got down to the office, and then I went down to the main part of the town where the jail was emptying, and that was not funny. What came out of that jail was not much better than what came off the Burma Railway. They had a very, very rough passage. But of course, the interesting part was that all the statues of Kwame Nkrumah were all being pulled down everywhere. But you see, Ghana, I still think Ghana is a very civilized country, because that afternoon, Kwame Nkrumah's wife and children were packed on a plane with all their belongings and sent to Egypt. She was an Egyptian, and they were put on the plane quite safely with all their belongings, and they went off to Egypt, things seemed to be more or less going back. And we all wondered what was going to happen to Nkrumah. He got as far as Sri Lanka, where his goodwill or whatever it was had run out, and they wouldn't let him have any petrol for his plane, and he got stuck there. And it was quite a long time before he could get back to Africa at all. He didn't come back to us. But by Monday, there wasn't a bullet hole visible anywhere. The streets and the circles and everything which had been labelled Nkrumah or Red Russia or something or other, all the names of the streets had all been changed. It was by Monday, things were back to absolutely back to normal, except that we hadn't got Kwame Nkrumah. We got another man instead.
Did you ever meet him?
Kwame, I did once, yes. He was a batty as a coot. But there's no doubt about it that he was very... It was interesting that he had Hannah Brown, who was one of Hitler's top women pilots, as his own pilot. She lived in... Did you know that? She lived in Accra with him and did all his piloting for him. And was very much, I wouldn't go so far as say he was a girlfriend, but he had some very peculiar girlfriends. But we disliked him, we disliked his regime, Well, I mean, we were in a very bad position anyway, I don't know why. But given his due, he had vision, and he was one of the few African leaders who really did have vision, because Ghana is, I won't say it's coasting, but Ghana is going on Nkrumah's vision now. He put in the dam, which everybody said was a foolish thing, and that it was a waste of time, a waste of money, and all the rest of it. He is selling, that Ghana is selling electricity to all the countries around from the dam. It has simplified the transport from the north to the south of Ghana very considerably, because whereas the roads are still pretty rough, but you can get on a boat in the north and you can come right down to the south, and no problem at all. He built Tema Harbour. There was no harbour. When we first went in, we had to go in. The big boats had to stay outside the reefs, and you had to get on the little boats and come in on little boats. But he built a harbour at Tema, which is still a beautiful harbour. It's going strong. It's going very well. He built the necessary roads. He put the necessary what was necessary then, he put them in as tarmac roads, and they are still going strong. He really did have vision, but oh boy, he's a nasty bit of work. But on the other hand, Ghana owes a great deal to him.
Was there much corruption there?
Corruption? Well, there was corruption everywhere. I don't know that we got involved very much in corruption, but it was, if you really wanted to get something done, you had to go and find the right man and say the right things and so on. But it all in the end went back to, it all went back from Nkrumah in the end. He was definitely the top notch on it.
Was he a dictator?
Oh yes. Oh yes. There's no doubt about it. He thought he had the army behind him, but he didn't. And he was beginning to be stupid in the kinds of oppression that he was beginning to bring in on men and women and individuals. I think most people admitted that he was definitely going round the bend at the end. But Ghana owes a great deal to him. And I don't think there was much else to say about Ghana, except that I've been back a number of times since, and Ghana was safe enough for the World YWCA to hold one of its 4 yearly world meetings in Ghana at the university. And it's the only time up till this last year when we had it in Egypt, it's the only time we've ever had one in Africa, that there's ever been anywhere in Africa safe enough to hold one.
And was this during Nkrumah's time?
This was just after Nkrumah. This was about 2 years after Nkrumah went. And it was good enough. We had the government came and opened the meeting for us. The government came and sat on the platform and opened the meeting for us. We had the meeting, which on the whole wasn't bad. Everybody complained about the food and one and another, but it worked. And we had all the photographs, and then we were getting, I was in Geneva, and we were getting all the reports ready of this big meeting. And we were going to have on the front page, we were going to have the then president, and our president, who was a Greek, I think, coming down the steps together to show amity between them. And about 3 days before we were due to get the report proofread, there was another coup in Ghana, and we had to change all the photographs. But again, it was a comparatively peaceful coup. And then I went back again when they were going through a very, very bad period, Financially, they were completely down the drain, and it was a very, very difficult period for everybody. And then I went back just after young Jerry Rawlings had taken over. And then I went back again after he'd been there some time, and I was back there again this spring. And there's no doubt about it, but Ghana is one of the countries that is making the grade. They've got problems with finance. Who hasn't got problems with finance? But I would say that in Africa, there are probably three, possibly four countries that are making the grade.
What are the? Who are the others?
And Ghana is one of them. Botswana. Botswana has always been multiracial. It had a multirace. Its boss married an English woman, and they got on very well together. And also, Botswana has got minerals. And Botswana has been financially stable, practically from the beginning, because it's had money. I think that one or two of the French ones, I think, I don't know enough about them to be able to say, but the other one that I think is now very much on the up and up, in spite of AIDS, is Uganda. Uganda have got a first-class chap in charge at the moment, absolutely first-class. And I think they're also making the grade. Kenya, which started with such very high hopes, has gone from bad to worse. And that's in an awful, Kenya's in an awful mess at the moment. And of course it's also got drought up in the north, because the government tried to do a whole lot of plantations. They tried to move a whole lot of people onto little holdings up in the north. And they did it when there were quite decent rains, and since then they've hardly had decent rains, and it's been an absolute catastrophe. But
Jerry Rawlings, you know, he was a very young man, wasn't he? Yes. Well, was he a Ghanaian?
Oh yes.
Yes.
He was Ghanaian. Yes. And he was in the Air Force, and he just had charisma. He never changed his title to president or colonel or whatever. He always stayed as lieutenant. I think they've got a new election coming up, and I think he wants to stand down now. So what's going to happen, I don't know. But
he's been good for the country,
hasn't
he?
He's been very good for them, yes. He's been very good for them, and they've had great respect for him. One of my very best friends from anywhere is a Ghanaian, and she has built her own empire in Ghana, and she's managed to keep going whoever was doing it. But she's had very good support from Rawlings, and she at one point she was doing all the government catering for whenever they had functions or anything. She was doing all the catering for.
And this is why
she started with a Y.
Yes.
And went from the Y to set up her own thing, and is now a power in the land, and a power in a lot of other lands as well.
What is her name?
Barbara Baita. Her father was the religious man at the University of Ghana. And last time I saw him, he was trying to translate the Bible into his own dialect. And he got an enormous saying in front of him, and he got his Bible there, and he was saying that, no, I think the Hebrew is better of that. And he'd pick up a book along the book of Hebrew. Yes, I think that, no, I think the Greek was better. And he'd go over there and get the Greek, and he'd have a look at the Greek. And he'd say, I think maybe the English. No, I think the Hebrew. And then he was going from one language to another, translating it into his own dialect. I mean, we don't always appreciate the people that are doing things in other countries. And Barbara has said, Barbara was Annie Jaggi's niece anyway. And Annie Jaggi was the UN representative. I mean, she was marvellous. And so Barbara came from a very good family, and two of her brothers are an ambassador somewhere now. But she's done it herself. It's a good country. I like Ghana. Mm.
And the situation of women, you know, you were saying this is one of the success stories of
post-colonial.
Oh, yes. Post-colonial.
The women are holding their own in almost everything there, I think, at the moment. The market women have always been the power in the land. I can remember one lot where the women market women got themselves into unions, so that they had again they had power. They could hold out against Nkrumah. I mean, the market women did. And because they got money, they probably had more money in the bank than Nkrumah did. But the interesting thing was that most of them didn't read or write. I remember working with the yam sellers union on one occasion, and they got two very, very powerful, charisma women as their secretary and chairman, but the business side of it was done by one of their nephews who could read and write. But they were turning over money at the rate of knots there, even when things were bad. The market women's unions were always good, and we did quite a lot of work with them with their children and so on and so forth. But
it makes one realise, you know, when the West puts in aid to countries like Ghana, you know, perhaps the importance of giving it to women in agriculture. Would you agree there?
I would say, you see, the problem in Africa, and I think it's been much more obvious in Africa than it has in any of the other countries that I've worked in, is that the African man, through the generations, looked after the cattle and spent most of his time trying to fight other tribes for more cattle, and then fighting other tribes for more land or for more women. But the African man was always fighting. Well, when the so-called Western civilization hit Africa, the women were still in their traditional occupations of looking after the family, feeding the family, marketing, bringing up the children, and the men had completely lost their reason for being at all. So it's one of the reasons, certainly in Africa, why the women have always played a fairly important part in things, because they were still with a feeling of their own security and importance behind them, whereas the men had lost theirs. And that's why when I was there in January, Tanzania, I think, and you could, in the evening or even during the day, if you went down the street, you would find groups of men watching television, sitting on the edge of the street, or drinking, or eating, while the women were working like mad in all directions, because the men, to a very large extent, particularly in the so-called lower classes, have not yet really found. This is one of the problems that's happening in Zimbabwe at the moment. You see, it's exactly the same thing. The educated people have managed fairly all right. This is a general comment on Africa, but it's something which I've certainly found almost everywhere in Africa where I've worked, is that some of the first people who went in were the missionaries. And I'm not saying anything against the missionaries. They did a tremendous amount of damage, but what the missionaries did was they picked out wherever they went, they picked out the intelligent tribe and they concentrated on the intelligent tribe, with the result that in due course the jealousy and the intertribal stuff grew up because of the education, the hospitals, and the concentration on the intelligent tribe. The Nigerian War was because the Igbos were the intelligent tribe that had been developed by the missionaries. Mau Mau and all that came too because the Kikuyu were the intelligent tribe which had been developed. To some extent, Ghana was also done with, because it was the Gars that they took over in Ghana, but Ghana has sorted itself out, in spite of the fact that the Ashantis consider themselves completely superior to everybody else. But they're